This is Larry Levitt from KaiserNetwork.org. Welcome to Elements of State Health Reform, a partnership with the National Governors Association. These interactive web shows look at the growing momentum for health reform in the states and probe the key issues policymakers are facing as they develop approaches to cover the uninsured and make health care more affordable. Today we're looking at the financing of state health initiatives. Many argue that financing, who pays and how much, is the key to reform. Without freeing up money, whether through new revenue sources or cost containment or both, there's no way to pay for expanded coverage. Many would also argue, though, that financing is the hardest element of reform. With a healthcare system that consumes one-sixth of the economy, it's inevitable that changes in financing will rile one or more powerful interests who can block the path to reform. We're joined by a panel of state and national experts to look at how leading states have financed health coverage expansions, how sustainable those approaches are, and what fiscal tools states have available to them. Amy Lischko is the outgoing Commissioner of Healthcare Financing and Policy in Massachusetts, where she played a key role in the universal coverage plan now being implemented there. She recently joined the faculty of Tufts Medical School. Trish Riley is joining us by phone from Maine, where she directs the Governor's Office of Health Policy and Finance and spearheads the state's efforts to expand coverage. She previously directed the National Academy for State Health Policy. And Jen Tolbert is a principal policy analyst with the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, where she is tracking and analyzing state reform efforts. You can ask questions of the panel by sending an email to ask@kaisernetwork.org. And thanks to all of you for joining us. And Amy, let's start with you. Many have pointed to Massachusetts as a model, perhaps, for other states of an approach for shared fiscal responsibility for reform. Give us a sense of what the pieces of that shared responsibility are.
Sure. Happy to, Larry. Well, I mean, first of all, I think part of the Massachusetts reform is really based on market reform. So we looked at the market and what was working and not working and really tried to reform that. Another piece of it was to provide better access to health insurance for people both of lower income means and also higher income. So really providing this connector structure that would help facilitate insurance purchase for all people in Massachusetts. And finally, for those that were lower income, we wanted to provide subsidies towards their health insurance. And we really redirected funding that was currently in the system away from institutions and towards subsidies for individuals.
And that funding that was in the system, that was both state dollars and federal dollars?
Absolutely. And the state dollars come from both an assessment on private purchasers and also on providers of care, hospitals. And then it's matched by federal funds.
So this is what's, part of that is what's known as the uncompensated care pool?
Exactly.
And how about the employer payments? I mean, one of the more controversial aspects was a requirement on employers to either provide coverage or pay a modest fee into the pool.
Absolutely. And I think that was part of the shared responsibility. But when you really look at the dollars that were projected to come from that funding stream, they're really relatively small. So the real shared responsibility for employers is really offering the health insurance. And most of them in Massachusetts currently are offering health insurance to their employees.
And this payment, which is $295 per year, is obviously much less than the cost of providing health insurance. So was that in some sense symbolic to get employers in the game?
I think the feeling was is that employers who are offering health insurance are currently participating in the uncompensated care pool and paying for the care of the uninsured. And the idea was to get all employers paying for the care of the uninsured. So that nominal fee really represents their share of contributing towards the cost of the care for the uninsured.
And how about the other piece of the Massachusetts plan was an individual mandate requiring people to have insurance, which is in the process of being implemented now. And that's often thought of as a coverage mechanism, the way to get people coverage. But in some sense, it's also a financing mechanism in terms of requiring people to participate financially in the system. How as the debate unfolded in Massachusetts, how was that individual mandate viewed?
I absolutely think you're right, that there are a lot of dollars that are out there that are going to be coming in from premium payments by people who are above the 300% of the poverty level. And I think that the sense was that when we ran the models, there was no way we were going to get 100% coverage or near 100% coverage without mandating people to have some level of basic insurance. So we really needed those healthy lives to come into the pool and help subsidize the care of people who are really sicker and can't afford health insurance.
And Trish Riley, let me bring you in. Thanks for joining us from up in Maine.
I'm sorry I'm not there in person.
Maine has been implementing an approach for a number of years now, DiRigo Health, which unlike Massachusetts is not universal but relies on voluntary enrollment with premium subsidies. Give us a sense of what the pieces of financing are to pay for those subsidies.
Well, I think the first thing is to step back and consider that it was a comprehensive reform, and it had three pieces. building on main care for the lowest income, a subsidized program for 100 to 300%, and market reforms and cost containment to make sure that employers and individuals could afford coverage and sustain it. That said, the subsidy piece was, and we didn't, unlike Massachusetts, we didn't have federal money at risk or any additional money. So the financing was from a one-time $53 million state funding, and then something called the savings offset payment. Because the reform was a comprehensive one aimed at cost, quality, and access, we said we wanted to bring down cost growth in the health system and reinvest those dollars to pay for the subsidies. So the savings offset payment was the vehicle to do it.
And talk about it a little bit. The savings offset payment was one of the more has been one of the more controversial aspects of the plan. And the idea here, as I understand it, is to assess how much savings you're accomplishing in the healthcare system, and then to recoup those through a fee on insurance carriers.
That's right. And as insurance carriers, third party administrators, anybody who pays in the state. And the notion was we would first have an independent adjudicatory hearing by a superintendent of insurance to determine whether and how much savings were achieved in the system, and the savings offset payment couldn't exceed that amount.
And what were the things you were doing in the plan in order to get the cost of healthcare down to generate these savings?
There are a number of activities of aggressive state health planning initiative. We have a certificate of need program to govern capital expenditures. Some of these are obviously very old initiatives, not new ideas. But we added to that a capital investment fund to limit the amount of capital expenditure going forward. We did rate regulation in the small group market and had voluntary targets that hospitals were asked to meet.
And Trish, you mentioned that you didn't have federal dollars at risk in the case of Massachusetts, which was looking at the potential end of a federal waiver. But federal dollars are certainly key to what you were able to achieve.
They are, and we did an expansion of the Medicaid program to expand parents from 150 to 200% like their children. We had have a design that would pool the dollars paid by employers, employees, and other sources and use those to help fund Medicaid, dual eligibles basically, people who are eligible for both Medicaid and the DIRGO program. That has been a very difficult goal to achieve.
What have been some of the difficulties?
The federal government continues to be resistant. They have not denied us the ability to do that, but continue to defer and raise questions. And employers have been resistant to their notion is, why not just send somebody directly to Medicaid?
And Jen Tolbert, let me bring you in. We talked about some of the pieces of these state reforms and federal dollars being certainly a major element of the financing of certainly these state initiatives. There are a number of ways that states can access these federal dollars, and one simple way, as Trish referred to, is simply to expand eligibility in existing public programs. What are the kind of key options? What are the key areas of flexibility states have to expand eligibility?
Right. Well, as you know, the Medicaid program and the CHIP program as well is a federal-state partnership. And so the federal government outlines broad requirements that states have to meet. But within those requirements, states have a great deal of flexibility over how they implement their programs and at what levels they establish eligibility. Now, with respect to eligibility, the federal government does specify which populations are eligible and also establishes minimum income-based eligibility thresholds. So, for example, in Medicaid, the populations that are eligible include children, pregnant women, parents, people with disabilities, and the elderly, all of whom must also be low income, although the income limits vary for the different populations. But states do have the ability to go beyond those minimum eligibility thresholds. And in fact, a number of states, as indicated by Maine, have done so. In fact, as of July 2006, 17 states covered children with family incomes above 200% of the federal poverty level, And 16 states covered low-income parents with incomes above or at 100% of the federal poverty level or above. So there is, again, a great deal of flexibility. And then one other point I'd like to make about that, while not an eligibility expansion per se, states can also take a number of steps to actually make it easier for people who are eligible for the program to enroll. And I think that's very significant because a number of the uninsured are actually eligible for Medicaid and CHIP but are not enrolled. Of the 9 million uninsured children, the estimates indicate that as much as 75% of those children are actually eligible for Medicaid or CHIP but are simply not enrolled. So these steps can really go a long way to getting and reducing the numbers of uninsureds in the states. And some of these strategies include shortening the application to maybe one or two pages, allowing people to use mail-in applications or to apply online. Also, states can provide 12 months of continuous eligibility. And so while a number of states have adopted these simplification strategies for children, they have yet to do so for parents. But again, if they choose to adopt some of these strategies, it could go a long way toward reducing the number of uninsured.
So there are all these approaches for expanding coverage within existing federal rules, whether it's expanding eligibility, mm-hmm. income eligibility, or making it easier for people who are already eligible to get in to the programs like SCHIP and Medicaid. There are also the opportunities for federal waivers that a number of states have used, Massachusetts being a prime example, to both bend, adjust some of these rules, or capture other streams of financing like disproportionate share payments. What are some of the approaches states, what are some of the limitations on that, and what are some of the approaches states have used to access these federal funds?
Right. Well, as you said, states can apply to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to obtain waivers of certain Medicaid and CHIP program requirements. Again, you know, a number of states have taken advantage of this. But one of the major constraints when it comes to these waivers is that there is a budget neutrality requirement, which means that states can spend no more through the waiver than they would have spent absent the waiver. So that does constrain to some extent the amount of funds that states can generate to expand coverage. Nevertheless, states have been very creative in finding ways to work within those budget neutrality constraints. And one thing I forgot to mention earlier is that a key population that is not currently eligible for Medicaid are childless adults, again, unless they have a disability and would qualify on that basis. So a number of states have actually used the waiver process as a way to provide coverage for these childless adults who would not otherwise be eligible for Medicaid.
So the idea of taking existing money and redirecting it in some way to cover populations that wouldn't otherwise be covered.
Right, exactly. And one obvious source of funds are Medicaid DSH payments or disproportionate share hospital payments and other payments that are paid directly to hospitals and other institutional providers. And so what a number of states have done is they've redirected those DSH payments into coverage expansions. Of course, one of the problems with that is the availability of DSH funds varies quite a great deal across the states. For example, the annual DSH allotment in Wyoming is $200,000 per year, while in New York it's over $1.5 billion. So again, the ability to do these coverage expansions somewhat depends on the availability of funding sources.
And the president also recently proposed, similar to these waivers, what he called the Affordable Choices Initiative, which allows states some flexibility, additional flexibility in redirecting these funds for private insurance. Give us a quick summary of what that Affordable Choices Initiative is and what it will allow states to do.
Sure. The Affordable Choices is actually a companion initiative to the president's broader proposal to actually change the tax treatment of health insurance. And the idea is that Affordable Choices would actually assist populations that would not benefit from the tax code changes, namely the poor and individuals with high healthcare costs that would find insurance, health insurance, still unaffordable. And so what it allows is it allows states to, again, redirect these institutional payments into funding coverage for certain populations. And I think it's important to note that the Affordable Choices does not provide states any new additional funding. Rather, it just grants them a flexibility outside of obtaining a waiver to redirect existing dollars.
And it also, I mean, on the one hand, provides this flexibility to redirect the money, but on the other hand, says that it can only be used for private insurance, not for traditional public coverage in Medicaid or SCHIP.
Right, right. And that, I think, is somewhat problematic and a bit more prescriptive than the administration has been previously, certainly with respect to Medicaid waivers, where clearly they're allowed to expand public coverage. But this does specify that in order to gain access to that flexibility, the coverage must be private coverage.
And at the same time that the president proposed this, also proposed a number of cuts to Medicaid in his budget request earlier this year. How do those cuts interact with the Affordable Choices Initiative?
Right. There is actually quite a strong interaction between some of the couple of the president's budget proposals and Affordable Choices. Earlier this year, the administration actually issued regulations that would severely limit payments that could be made to public providers, including public hospitals. And so effectively, what that regulation, what these new regulations would do, would be to severely limit one of the sources of funding that might be available under Affordable Choices, and those are supplemental payments, also known as upper payment limit payments or UPL payments. And then in addition, in the budget, the president proposed eliminating Medicaid payments for graduate medical education, which again, another source of payments to institutional providers. And combined, these changes proposed by the president could reduce the available funds through Affordable Choices by $5.6 billion over 5 years. So a significant hit to the available funds.
And Amy, let me come back to you. Massachusetts, this issue of the federal waiver you had and the pressure that put on to get reform done, what were the pieces that Massachusetts had put in place earlier that put mm-hmm. put the state in this position to actually move forward?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think in the mid-90s, we expanded health insurance to cover, as Jen mentioned, those childless adults up to 100% of the federal poverty level that were long-term unemployed. So we had a great program that was almost full Medicaid coverage. It was a slightly smaller package. We also had other programs where we expanded to children. We expanded to pregnant women. We expanded to people who were unemployed. There was a program that they could purchase their COBRA coverage much, much more affordably. So there were a number of programs that we had already put in place which reduced our uninsured dramatically in the mid-90s, and we were able to build upon that with this current reform.
And the waiver that Massachusetts ended up getting to allow the reform to go forward, for how many years does that lock this financing into place?
Well, we only have another year, unfortunately, which is problematic. I think we have to show some success over the next year to have the feds continue to provide us with this funding. But I think that it actually, even though we stood to lose that money, it actually put a pressure that was probably needed at the time to really move healthcare reform along. We had begun the process before CMS told us that they were going to pull back on this funding. And actually, when they did that, it really created a momentum that we really needed to do something. We really need to look at the system and change the payments in order to be able to keep that funding coming to Massachusetts. So I saw it as really a good thing, although many around the table at the time saw it as a pretty negative thing.
And Trish Riley, there have been some recent reexamination of some of what you're doing in Maine, and the governor has proposed some changes to the structure of the program and the financing. What are some of the changes that the governor has been looking at?
Yeah, I think all of us have to realize, that, and I know we do, that health reform is a tough road to hoe, and it's got to be viewed as a work in progress, so you can make change as you move. We've just proposed what we're lovingly calling Virgo 2.0. And a big piece of what it will do is address directly and head-on the controversy around the financing. Because in the end, any initiative to try to cover the uninsured really is about affordability. Who's going to pay? Clearly, the parties who were paying the savings offset payment resisted that, took us to court. We won at the Superior Court. It's now before the Supreme Court here. Regardless of what happens in the courts, the political pushback on the SOP was such that we're proposing a redefinition of it, making it a surcharge on hospital bills, not unlike what happened in Massachusetts early on, that all payers will pay. And it will be based on the amount of actual care provided to previously uninsured and underinsured covered through DIRGO. Importantly, we started out our system. We have a cost crisis that's pretty significant in this state. We started off the DIRGO reforms with the notion that we needed to create the main quality forum, work around health planning, do everything we could to bring some cost constraint to the system, believing that we needed to do that first before we talked about any kind of mandates. We've worked now for 4 years at that initiative, and so the DIRGO 2.0 also includes a recommendation for employer-payer play and an individual mandate, as well as a proposal for a reinsurance program to help address the costs in the individual market.
And where do these proposals stand right now?
The bill has just been printed and will be before a legislative committee in the next 10 days.
Understandable why you're stuck with me. Well, I want to move on to some questions that we've gotten by email, and we've gotten quite a few. Start with a question that comes back to some of the market reforms that we actually began the discussion with. And it's a person who writes, I have insulin-dependent diabetes. The cost of any private insurance who might offer an insurance for a person with any chronic condition, even one like mine, where I've had no complications in 50 years, would be prohibitive. And Amy, let me come back to you, because a piece of the Massachusetts reforms, which I think are integral to the financing, are the insurance market reforms. And explain what you did in Massachusetts.
Sure. And I think to start with, every state is different, and I'm guessing this gentleman is not from Massachusetts, because in Massachusetts we don't do health status rating in any of our non-group or our small group markets. So we began in a place that was much more friendly to people who are sick, I would say. And in any kind of larger form like this, you're going to have to do that or have community rating or do something different to get at that sick people shouldn't be paying more than healthy people. So I think we started out with that as a base. What we did do is merge the markets for individual purchase and small group purchase into one market because there was an unlevel playing field. And someone who was not offered health insurance by their employer was really relegated to the non-group market at rates of about 40% higher for the same, basically the same age and the same geography as someone who was working for a small employer who did offer health insurance. It didn't seem fair. Product availability was different in the two markets. Very little choice in the non-group market or the individual purchase market, much more choice in the small group market. So we really merged those markets together and made it more transparent for people.
It was a drive to a universal, defining the system as universal. Was that key to making some of these changes in the market?
Sure. I mean, we wanted to make the individual purchase of insurance easier and more affordable. And so in order to get people who work multiple jobs, people who don't fit neatly into the employer market, we wanted to be able to provide more affordable insurance to them.
And Trish, you mentioned some changes you made up in Maine in the small group market. What were those?
We did rate regulation in the small group market for the first time, and required a medical loss ratio of 78%. So that was at least a step in that direction. We too have been a community rating state and one of six or seven states that have community rating in the individual market, although with our reinsurance plan, we do propose some modification of the community rating bands, which will be a significant debate here in this state. But we have an individual market that's in pretty great challenge. Our DIRGO Choice product has for 4 years combined the individual and small group in the product itself, and that is one of the initiatives following both our experience and what Massachusetts is doing that we're studying with our Bureau of Insurance to see if that's something that would work here, although the marketplace is very different than Massachusetts.
And I want to come to another email, which gets at the issue of benefits, which is in some sense the flip side of financing. You can only finance what you know you have to finance. And the question is, it has to do with how you identify the needs of the uninsured. How do you go about finding information pertaining to the uninsured healthcare needs for formulating a standard benefits package? Since there are no billing codes or other ways to really aggregate this group's healthcare utilization, what methods do you use for the uninsured? And that question's from Maryland. And Trish, give a sense, when you were designing these subsidized products, give a sense of the process that you went through to figure out what were the appropriate benefits to include, the appropriate level of cost sharing, and also then costing out those products, projecting the cost.
In 10 words or less. Well, we did a series. We have had a household survey of our uninsured that the Muskie School of the University of Southern Maine had done that was very, very, very important. We also did a series of focus groups and tested various approaches. We had a health action team of people that included many consumer advocates and a benefit design committee. So there was a good deal of work that went into it. As a result, we landed on the side of fairly rich benefits, and the Dirigo Choice benefit is a unique product in the marketplace, which, with, of course, the concomitant potential for adverse selection. It's a program with first-dollar preventive coverage, a Healthy Maine Rewards program that gives cash benefits for people to select a primary care physician and sign up and get a health risk assessment, noting that uninsured people need to make the break from emergency rooms. It's the only product in the marketplace for small groups and individuals with mental health parity and with no pre-existing condition exclusions. In order to get, people don't see the value of buying insurance if they have to wait 6 months to get any kind of service for their illnesses. So that was the general product design.
And did you feel you had the data or sufficient data to make an estimate of what this package would cost, or did you feel somewhat hamstrung?
We did then, but then you get in the middle of it and you find it. Whoops! I think all of us would. I bet you Amy will agree. And even though Massachusetts is a state rich in academic institutions and resources, I think we never really have the information we need. It's still a little bit. Most of the data tends to be very old. The marketplace changes very quickly. When we were doing some of our early estimates, the participation in employer marketplace was different. The incredible growth of high deductible plans in this state happened very quickly. So I think it's hard for the data to keep up with the reality.
And Amy, we had John Kingston on the show a few weeks ago talking about the definitions of affordability and the establishment of the package. One of the interesting things about Massachusetts is a lot of this was not defined in the legislation when it was passed. It was left to this connector board to determine what was affordable, and then to also figure out what that could buy in the marketplace and what types of benefits should be mandated. What was, to the extent you can speak to it, in the legislative process, in the process of getting this passed, what was the thinking in terms of how much level of detail to put in legislation and how much to leave till afterwards?
Well, I mean, I think part of it was we were under a time crunch, really. We needed to pass something in order to get the federal approval of our waiver, and when we needed to be pushing forward on that. And some of these decisions were just really difficult to make. I think the sense was that there was a new administration coming on soon, and that it'd be better not to put these in. We wouldn't get agreement from all parties that we needed to get agreement if we actually put it into the statute. And so we would leave a lot of the decision-making until later. And I think that's been problematic in some ways and good in other ways. It's better to have a little bit more of a thoughtful process on some of these issues and to have more data available. On the question of the data on what do the uninsured need, we were lucky enough to have the uncompensated care pool claims, which we had been collecting for a number of years, which gave us a very nice profile of the care, at least that patients were receiving in hospitals and community health centers. And we were able to really see that population of uninsured that were using the uncompensated care pool really looked much like any other population. There was very expensive high users on one end, but most people were really pretty low utilizers. And so that gave us comfort that we were able to have that data, and it looked very much like any other insurable population.
And Jen, most states don't have an uncompensated care pool like that.
Exactly.
Their experience is primarily with the Medicaid program or the SCHIP program for kids. The state's looking to expand to other populations who aren't now eligible or enrolled in, let's say, Medicaid. How similar does the current uninsured population look to people currently on Medicaid?
Well, I think it's safe to say that the Medicaid population probably has a higher disability profile than the uninsured, because, you know, certainly one way to qualify is on the basis of disability. But I think if you segment certain populations, low-income parents, for example, and children, that the uninsured, again, because two-thirds of the uninsured are low-income, that they're likely to look somewhat similar to those populations. But I think you need to be careful not to assume that the uninsured are going to look exactly like the Medicaid enrollees simply because of the disability component.
But I think if I can add, it depends on what your Medicaid program looks like, too. Urban just did a study for us in Maine that's pretty interesting and shows that they found that the uninsured in Maine are actually healthier than the insured. And that would be our experience as well in Dirigo. The adverse selection that was worried the insurers didn't really happen here. And I think that may be because we are a state with about 21% of our population on the Medicaid program, including, as in Massachusetts, childless adults who tend to be pretty high needed and low income. Mm-hmm. So when you have a state with a robust Medicaid program, I think the uninsured look healthier, and as a result are not as risky to take on.
Mm-hmm. And that makes sense. And both Maine and Massachusetts, I think, you know, we're starting with a relatively low level of uninsured, as Amy talked about some of the expansions that you had already done in Massachusetts. Jen, give us a sense. I mean, with states starting in very different places, what kind of challenges does that pose for a state that has, let's say, 15-20% uninsured rather than 10% uninsured?
Yeah, it poses a real significant challenge, and I think that's why we're seeing some states taking on the challenge of reform and significant coverage expansions, and others focusing much more on more incremental, smaller coverage expansions. And I think that has to do in part with the uninsured population that they have in their states, as well as the available resources. And I think that varies significantly across the states. But I think it's important to note that despite the disparity in available resources and the differences in the uninsured populations, that currently we have a significant number of states that are looking at coverage expansions. And, you know, and I think it's important to keep in mind that there are a lot of states out there doing some smaller expansions, and while they're not going to get the press and the attention of, you know, what Massachusetts is doing and what California has proposed, nevertheless, these are significant steps in the right direction and something that we haven't seen for a number of years.
We've been talking a lot about the, you know, who may or may not be covered in Medicaid or other public programs. And we had a question from Washington about, in particular, providing coverage to uninsured individuals who are not typically eligible for Medicaid benefits, legal permanent residents with fewer than 5 years in the U.S., undocumented individuals, and what type of financing might be available for those kinds of expansions. In Massachusetts, how did the law treat people, let's say undocumented immigrants or legal immigrants who have been here less than 5 years?
Right. The undocumented immigrants are really still left out of the picture. Part of that is just the way the federal funding works, and we always knew there would be some residual pool left. I think the thought is that the pool will have to be redesigned and recalibrated. Perhaps it'll look more like insurance than it does today for those populations, because certainly some of those populations have a means to do some cost sharing and to have some selected networks and other issues that are more look like insurance. But they were left out of the reform in a big way. And also, we don't have a lot of data on how many undocumented immigrants there really are and what their income levels are, what their needs are. We really don't have that information. It's hard. That's a really difficult one to work with.
And Trish, are there groups such as immigrants who have been folded into the reform plan who weren't previously eligible for Medicaid?
It's obviously not as striking a problem here.
Yeah.
But in our the reform that we're going forward with, we have a definition of residency that would open the program to more people.
Great.
Can I?
Oh yeah,
add
sure.
A point? Just to say that one area where there has been some effort and to expand coverage, particularly to immigrants, both legal and undocumented, is in the area of children's coverage. Illinois, with its All Kids program, is covering all children, regardless of immigration status. And Governor Schwarzenegger, as part of his universal coverage proposal, would cover all children up to 300% of poverty, again, regardless of immigration status, through their healthy families program. And so, again, partly I think states are able to do this because children are a relatively healthy, low-cost population, but it's part of, I think, a broader effort just to focus on children's coverage. And by, you know, as folks in Illinois have said, by stating that everyone is eligible, it's a real opportunity to bring a lot more children into the program.
And are there federal dollars available, federal matching dollars available for expansions like that, or are those state-only dollars?
No, those must be funded with state-only dollars. And again, the reason the states can do the children's coverage is because these are a relatively inexpensive population to cover. So, so states can often find the money within their budget.
And in California, for example, they're not talking about providing coverage or insurance to undocumented adults.
Adults,
like
right.
Kids.
Right. Important distinction, yes.
Well, in turn, we got another email from New Jersey, and a bit of an administrative question. How do you cover residents who may not pay taxes? Tax-paying residents can be followed and contacted by Social Security numbers, but if you don't have one of those, how do we keep track, driver's license numbers, other ideas? And Amy, let me start with you with an individual mandate. This was presumably a key issue of how you find those people and enforce the mandate.
And the mandate is real. The individual mandate is really going to be enforced through the tax return. So if someone doesn't file tax returns, they're really under the radar screen at this point. I mean, I think the initial feeling was we set some standards for the both the employers and the individuals, and then as Trish mentioned, you're going to have to revisit a lot of these issues after a year or two and go back and say, you know, did this work? Do we have to get tougher? Do we have to ease up? And so, but initially it is through the tax returns, and I'm not sure what you do with people that fly under the radar screen on all those laws.
And did the Universal Coverage Plan require creation of new or contemplation of new data systems, new administrative systems that didn't exist before?
There are a couple of new data collection systems in order to be able to validate and verify across employers and insurers and the tax returns to make sure that all the data are consistent. So there are a couple of different places. We tried to reduce the burden as much as we could so that we weren't increasing the paper trail and also the ability for people to steal identification numbers and whatnot. But there were numerous different data collection pieces that were instituted through the law.
And Trish, you talked about one of the ideas now being considered as an individual mandate up in Maine. How far have you gotten to defining how that would work?
Well, in our proposal, what we want to do is first we connect as a result of a Blue Ribbon Commission that helped us think through the next steps. We said that there needs to be both an employer mandate and an individual mandate, like Massachusetts, that they're related. You can't do one without the other. But the proposal will ask the legislature to put into effect an employer payer play taking effect July 108 and an individual January 109 and set a process in place to figure out the details and come back to the legislature with rulemaking to implement the program. So I think we want to get people around the table to figure out who's covered at what costs. The Blue Ribbon Commission suggested that we would look at individuals with incomes over 400% of poverty only, at least to begin with.
And what's been the reception so far to the idea of an individual mandate?
Mixed. Again, I think we're trying to make the case that it's an individual and an employer. They go hand in glove. And I think there's been a sense of equity that people paying something toward the program, toward the uninsured, makes some sense. There's been a reaction from employers who do provide coverage that it's fair. And there's certainly a very well-understood concept in Maine that there is a hidden tax, the bad debt and charity care, the uncompensated care that results when those of us who pay premiums pick up the cost of the uninsured. That's well understood, but I think it's going to be quite a debate in this state.
And how much on the employer side of a mandate, we talked earlier about in Massachusetts it being a fairly modest requirement on employers of $295, have you gotten as far to think about how large the requirement on employers would be and how key a part that is of the financing versus more of a fairness and equity issue?
It's a little bit of both. It's clearly hooked into our second year financing in this proposal, and we need to generate about half our revenues that way, a little less. So it's both equity and financing. And I just missed the. It's very hard to. There's an echo on this line, so I'm sorry, I missed the second part of the sentence. Good question.
No, that's okay. You answered it, but thanks. And I want to go back to our emails. And this is a big question, which is the panelists' sense of the potential for major healthcare policy reform at the federal level, and how that affects what states are doing with respect to needs for healthcare change. And Trish, let me stay with you. You've spent time certainly up in Maine, but also in Washington. What's your sense of how likely reform is at the federal level?
Well, anybody who's doing health reform has to be an optimist because it's hard work. Keep plugging away. So we cannot do this as states alone. We just don't have deep enough pockets, and there are constantly barriers that you hit, not the least of which are ERISA. But I think the next presidential campaign has got to focus on this issue, and the states have got to keep the pressure on. It strikes me that the more states do the more different kinds of reform and keep this reform discussion going, the more likely we are to have national response, only because there'll be chaos in the field. Multi-state employers, multi-state insurers certainly don't like the variation that these promising state initiatives will create, and I think that actually is encouraging for a national solution.
And how do you, I mean, as someone who is working at the state level, in Maine, as a specific example, how did you frame the debate at the state level? How do you, as a state policymaker, say on the one hand there needs to be a federal solution, that's the only way this can work, but here in Maine we should act?
Well, I think two things. One is the compelling needs of people without coverage, and that we know that people who wait too long to get covered, of course, cost the system a great deal of money, but more importantly, cost their own health and productivity. And I think, secondly, is the issue that the states have to show by example. This is too big a bite for the federal government to take without some experimentation. And we constantly harken back to the examples. The Congress only passed the state children's health insurance program after, 26 states had done it, HIPAA after 40-some. Even Part D was after states did low-income pharmacy assistance programs. So I think that keeps us going, the notion that we need to experiment, we need to learn, we need to take on this task in smaller states before the Congress will be willing to take it on for the nation.
And Trish, one of the things you mentioned was ERISA, and we actually just got an email in from out in California, which is which are debating their own health reform plan about ERISA, and whether there's been a challenge to the Massachusetts plan. And just as a little bit of context, we covered this a few weeks ago, that ERISA puts some restrictions on what states can do in terms of legislating or regulating employee health benefit plans, and cannot impose rules that relate to employee health benefit plans. And Amy, to your knowledge, has there been an ERISA challenge in Massachusetts?
And I think we're walking a tightrope here, and we've been very careful in the implementation to honor the agreement that was made with the employer community and to really try to follow through. And, I mean, so far it's worked. I think there's been a few issues, particularly around credible coverage, which, although doesn't directly require employers to offer a certain level of coverage, it does indirectly by requiring individuals to maintain a certain level of coverage, and there could potentially be a challenge there. There could also potentially be a challenge around the Section 125 plan implementation, where, again, although it's not an ERISA plan technically, it's an administrative function that I believe could be challenged by employers as more administrative work than what we previously had. And so there are places where if an employer or a large employer or a coalition of employers were upset about the way things were being implemented, and they could challenge, but it hasn't been yet.
And I think that was the other part of your question, actually, Larry, to me, that I forgot. Massachusetts has taken some criticism for, as has Vermont, for the smallness of the penalty for non-participating employers. But I think when one studies ERISA, it's really clear that the state can't explicitly impact the financial have a financial impact on health plans. So the smaller the penalty, the more likely I think you avoid going head to head with ERISA.
And we also talked last time about the importance of uniformity in protection against ERISA as well. And there was a recent case in Maryland that challenged the law that applied, had the effect of just applying to one large employer, Walmart, and that was thrown out by the courts. I want to come back to emails, and this one is from out in Colorado. It gets back to the question of a basic level of benefits that people should have. And how that interacts with assessments of the cost of the system. And Trish, let me ask you. I mean, you didn't have you haven't had a mandate in Maine, but you did establish a package of benefits. And how significant was cost in that calculation?
It was significant, but there was the balancing act about, you know, bare bones products have historically not been successful in marketing. And if you've got an uninsured population that have needs, you want to make sure you have a comprehensive benefit package. So we clearly stood on the side of a comprehensive benefit package. As we proceed and as the cost issues grow, we, like other states, are confronted with issues of benefit design and the notion of should there be different benefit designs a la Massachusetts for younger people. It's a debate that will be part of our 2.0 reform discussion.
And you mentioned that the DIRGO 2.0 is in imminently in legislative form. Is this something you expect to happen this year?
Yes.
Well, that was a short definitive answer.
It needs to. We have people on the rolls who need to continue coverage. We need to get some certainty about the financing, and I think we need to move to the next step and really say, as we said 4 years ago, the notion of a voluntary program achieving universality is not possible, but you got to start. My thought was you started in a voluntary mode and then need to move to the mandates.
And how has enrollment been running under the voluntary program relative to what you expected?
Well, that's been the controversy nationally. The number that has been bandied about was a number that was established in some early projections in May of 2003, before the bill was passed, before it was amended, before it was we went out to bid, before we knew what the insurance companies would bid, et cetera, et cetera. I think we are satisfied that this is a robust and successful program, largely because there's a nonprofit health plan that's operating in Maine and has been for about 6 years that has 11,000 members, and we have well beyond that and have served 25,000 between the DIRGO Choice product and the parent expansion since we began. So I think we clearly need to look at issues of affordability. Part of the DIRGO reform will lower the amount of employer contributions required and make some other reforms to try to make this program more affordable, including seeking becoming self-administered, because the issue clearly is making it more affordable to get enrollment more targeted, particularly for the uninsured.
And just to clarify that, right now in Maine, it's administered through a private insurance company,
Anthem. That's right. Yep. And we went out to bid. Anthem's the largest insurer here, has the best network and the best negotiated rates. So we're pleased that they joined us. But I think at this point, there's been significant issues with. I think it's fair to say private insurers don't have as core competencies the kind of unique capacities to market and then do benefits designs for the uninsured and underinsured.
And Amy, in Massachusetts, the mandate, I mean, was there a point in the discussion where a voluntary system like in Maine was considered?
Yes. Early on, I think the discussion was around just making health insurance more affordable and pretty much that being it, because the funding streams were unclear where we were really going to come up with the funding. And I think that was really the point where we had to use that funding for something else, so we freed up the money for subsidies. And you really can't have a mandate unless you have subsidies for low-income people to be able to purchase it. And so the subsidy mandate went hand in hand, and we didn't have that funding stream until we stood to lose the funding from the federal government. So I think that's where we really began to talk about the individual mandate in a really earnest way. I think before then we had run the models and said, well, if you have a voluntary program, you might get 10,000 people in, but you're really not going to have a big reform. And you have to make a decision whether you really want to do something big or whether you want to do something more incremental.
And Jen, where would you say the momentum is running in the states throughout the country? Is the idea of a mandate, an individual mandate, or employer requirement catching on, or are more states pursuing more incremental and voluntary approaches?
Well, you have a handful of states that are looking at universal coverage, and I think they're somewhat split. California and Pennsylvania and a proposal in Oregon seem to be including an individual mandate. Proposal in Illinois, however, is voluntary. So I think states are still somewhat split on the concept of the individual mandate and whether it's necessary to achieve significant coverage expansions. But when it comes to an employer mandate or an assessment or participation, however you want to phrase it, I think there is much more uniformity across the states that that employers do need to participate in the system by in some way, whether they offer insurance or pay into a pool if they choose not to offer. So I think, again, much more uniformity over including an employer mandate.
Pamina, we're coming approaching the end of the hour, and I want to we've been talking a lot about the way, particularly Maine and Massachusetts, put together their financing and achieved shared responsibility. I want to talk a little bit about how you see this going into the future. And Amy, you've now left government. Maybe you're freer to discuss this. Maybe not. But what's your sense of the sustainability of the financing in Massachusetts? I mean, healthcare costs have been consistently growing far faster than GDP, far faster than inflation, than workers' wages, than state revenues, for that matter. How sustainable is the model that you put in place?
Without constraining costs, I think it's not sustainable. And I think that was one of the decisions that was made not to put into statute, as Maine did, but the cost containment strategies to leave off the table, to develop a committee to look at those issues. But without some really significant changes, payment reform, and changes in costs and in the structure of healthcare costs, I don't think it is sustainable. I think, you know, we're headed down a scary road without putting those. And those are the more difficult, in some ways, the more difficult choices to make, and why we couldn't make those before the bill was passed. I think, you know, really changing, you're going to be taking money out of somebody's pocket, and those are really the difficult decisions. I think we felt that access had to be tackled first. At Maine, really tried to do them simultaneously. We felt that we really needed to stop the cost shifting from the uninsured to the insured and really get all the dollars out on the table and make the system more transparent, and then we could tackle the cost issues. But not a lot of progress in the past year has been made on those issues. Really no progress, I would say. And so we're really looking to this the Healthcare Quality Cost Council to really move forward on some of those issues in the next year.
And how the state obviously reached the judgment that it was more achievable to get the first piece done without the cost containment and do the cost containment later. How hard will it be to do the cost containment absent some of these other changes? I mean, in other words, is it easier, looking back, do you think it's easier to split these issues, or would it have been easier to actually do them all at once?
Well, I don't know that we would have gotten a bill passed. And I think the momentum was there to pass something. And so I'm mixed on that. But I think that those are more difficult decisions to make, where you're really going to hone in on costs. No one's really come up with a good answer for that. It's really technology-driven largely, so there's some money to be saved by administrative costs and quality improvements, but it's really technology-driven, and how you're going to be able to fight that, I'm not sure how we're going to be able to get our arms around it, but clearly that's going to make the program unsustainable moving forward unless we do grapple with that.
And Trish, how about Maine? With the version 2.0 improvements, is this what you think is a sustainable financing structure?
I think that's always the challenge for these programs, because I think it's very hard for a state alone mm-hmm. to finance major and sustainable reform. And I think, you know, our efforts have been to try to do cost, quality, and access together. And the challenge, as Amy well points out, one person's cost containment is another person's salary. So a lot of the efforts we've launched for cost containment are long-term and will take a while to realize. Notably, we've created a Maine Quality Forum working with the provider industry around evidence-based practice and the kinds of things that bring efficiencies to the system. We have a revitalized state health planning effort to try to deal with the variation in healthcare costs and a very active debate in the state, and not an uncontentious one. But I think you got to keep people to the table on this one, and I do think there needs to be national leadership, particularly around the kinds of criteria. But does everybody, the new rage of pay for performance worries me if we don't have a standardized set of performance measures that everybody measures against. So I think there's a role for the federal government in all this as well.
And when you passed the original plan in Maine, would you say the addition of these cost containment elements made it easier or harder to pass?
I think people did understand that this is a comprehensive system and that we have to take all parts of it and that all the players have a role to play. I think the bigger challenge is achieving the kind of cost containment goals that one wishes to achieve.
And did you say, I mean, we talked earlier about the controversy of these savings offset payments, which are in some sense a measure of at least part of the success of the cost containment.
Right.
And was that, how much of that controversy was about the estimates or the imprecision of the estimates, and how much was it about the actual savings you were trying to achieve?
I think it was both, and I think it was also motivated by no one likes to pay for this. Everybody, you know, there's always the issue of affordability and who pays. But I think a big piece of it was around the issue of what is cost savings. It's really in large measure cost avoidance, and cost avoidance doesn't necessarily give people a line of sight to see real dollars in their pockets. Although it's how we do our state budgets, when we always talk about cutting budgets, it's a cut against increases.
Right.
When we try to identify, and we did, in an independent adjudicatory process, we showed $78 million worth of savings that was identified and documented, and yet it was much of it avoided costs as opposed to real savings. Part of it, of course, being the recapture of bad debt and charity care that was avoided.
And was there any discussion in Maine during this process of, in addition to the insurers not wanting to pay, which is certainly understandable, no one wants to pay, but was there any recognition that this is a measure of success, that this large amount of savings offsets are a sign of the success of the program?
Yes, and I think there was some of that, but I think it was offset by loud and well-financed voices of opposition who clearly resisted our notion of linking savings to payments.
And, Jen, our state folks on the show here have certainly talked a lot about the necessity of the federal dollars in the system, and not just now, but going forward in terms of the sustainability. One of the big debates on Capitol Hill this year is going to be the S-CHIP reauthorization, which could impact the ability of states to go forward with some of these reforms. Talk a little bit about what the issues are in that debate and how those will impact the ability of states to move ahead.
Right. I think it will have a definite impact because so many states are using, particularly when looking at covering children, are using CHIP, the SCHIP program, as a mechanism for doing that. Some of the issues that are on the table have to do with who should be covered by the program. The president has stated that this is a program for low-income children, and therefore he believes that the program and eligibility should be maintained at about 200% of the federal poverty level. Already a number of states cover children above that limit. Many more states are looking to do so. But then there's the issue of financing. The financing that's built into the baseline is $5 billion a year, which is not even enough to continue to cover all of the children that are currently in the program. And so if there's any talk of expanding at the federal level, it's going to require a significant additional money, talking about $50 billion in additional funding that's needed. But however the debate plays out, again, it will definitely impact the ability of states to continue moving forward, and particularly those states that have relied on expansions of their CHIP programs as a fundamental base on which they're building broader coverage expansions.
Well, we'll be looking at some of these issues in a few weeks when we tackle kids coverage in the States as an element of reform, but we have to wrap it up there. Thanks to our panel of experts, and thanks to you for joining us. I'm Larry Levitt, and you've been watching KaiserNetwork.org. We'll see you next time for Elements of State Health Reform.